Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade from the 18th century to the 20th. Original music and immersive sound design accompany us on our storytelling journey. Listen to and follow History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, speaking of Kansas State, as a flagship station for K-State Athletics here on 96.5 The Fan, a lot of college basketball occurred over the weekend. And if you're a K-State fan, you know, I had said last week that while their chances were slim, they weren't none in making the NCAA tournament. They're none now.
Oh, they've been none for a while.
I don't agree. I think they had an outside chance.
I mean, they would have needed to basically win out.
Oh, they would have had to have.
That was like a super far outside chance.
I agree, but it wasn't zero. It's zero now.
It's like a 1.6%.
Yeah, before. It's a zero now. You lose to K-State yesterday. You lose to Arizona State yesterday, 66-54 at home. You lose to an Arizona State team that was 3-12 in the Big 12 by double figures at home. It's wraps at this point. CJ Jones had 10 points. David Ngessen had 20 in the game. Coleman Hawkins didn't play. It's over. The season is a wrap if you're the K-State Wildcats. Give them some credit for the fight that they showed throughout this season. They could have just laid down when they were sitting there struggling, you know, in the midway point of the year when they really got into Big 12 play to start the year. And so I think they certainly, not that I ever thought he was going to get fired, but they definitely bought Rodney Foster, or not Rodney Foster, Jerome Tang, an extra year. But that's about it. It's not much beyond that. So they'll have him through next year, and you just got to try to bounce back. This is a tough one with the, you know, with the way Jerome Tang recruits. He's a very, very much a proponent of the transfer portal. And it shows you the dichotomy, I think, of the transfer portal. When you look at K-State this season and you look at Mizzou this season, because they both took a very similar approach in attacking the transfer portal, and one was a hit and one was a miss. And that's just the nature of recruiting with NIL in the portal nowadays, is that you go out and you try to fill these immediate needs. And if it doesn't work, if the collective pieces don't come together and work as a team, it can kind of blow up in your face. And that's what it did for Jerome Tang and company this season. It's boom or bust. And it was a bust.
Basketball and soccer, I think, are the two sports where chemistry matters the most, because a lot of times creativity is really kind of the name of the game in those sports. And, you know, obviously, yeah, they call plays and, hey, we want you to do this in this scenario. But there's a lot of improv that happens out there on the court and on the field in those respective sports. And so when you just go out here and just kind of find the best players that money can buy, and that's your strategy for building your squad out, sometimes you end up with a situation like this. I mean, we see this all the time in the NFL. Like, every year there's a team in the NFL that spends a bunch of money in free agency, builds a team that's supposed to be competitive, and like, sometimes those teams make the playoffs. Sometimes those teams end up like the Jets, where you go out there and you spend all these resources to try to build the best possible team you can, kind of like a Madden. And you might have a bunch of guys that have high ratings on there, but they don't work well together because they don't play within a system that fits, because you have all these guys that kind of fit different systems. And that's kind of like what you're seeing with K-State, is like all these guys were like the best player on their respective teams before they went to K-State. And then they go and get big money to go to K-State. And it's like, now you're in a situation where you have all these guys who have all these egos, and not every one of those guys wants to be a role player. A lot of these guys are like, hey, I'm getting paid good money. I want to be a star here. I came to K-State to be a star. But there's one ball out there. So you got to, there's a lot of, that's the reason why like chemistry is so important in that sport, in soccer too. You see a lot of teams out there, hey, we're just going to go get the best names we can. And then you end up with players that are good, but they don't like each other and they don't play well together. So that's kind of what I've seen with K-State this year is they got a lot of talent, but those guys don't really seem to play well together because they don't really fit those puzzle pieces don't really fit together real well.
You can overcome a lot with talent, right? If you're the more talented team, you can overcome a lot of obstacles. Two things I don't think you can overcome are scheme and chemistry. Like you were just mentioning there, it's all fun and games, but if you've got a guy who is an incredibly talented one-on-one isolation sort of player, and you run more of a regimented five out or four out, one in kind of system where, you know, ball movement is working, you know, back and forth quite a bit, or you're playing against a team that's running a 2-3 zone, and this guy is just your typical isolation one-on-one on the perimeter kind of guy, it doesn't work. When you bring in a big who is accustomed to a four out, one in sort of system, and you run with a two guard and one, you know, one wing, two forward sort of look, it doesn't work. When you've got a center or a power forward who's accustomed to being the only guy in the lane, and you've now got two bodies playing 10 to 12 feet or closer to the bucket, it gets trafficked, right? Things get gummed up there in the paint. It doesn't always work well. And like you said, you know, you bring in two guys from a mid-major school that were averaging 16 a game or 20 a game, and they were first team all conference in their leagues last year. And you bring in a guy from another power, you know, high major school that was a player of the year in his conference. And you've got these two guys coming back who are all Big 12 performers from a year ago or what have you. And now you've got to try to get five or six or seven or more of these guys who were all conference, you know, potential All-American, whatever it was, all these postseason accolade guys to try to fit together when you've only got, as you said, one basketball to go around, doesn't always work. And when you have a group of guys that are all accustomed to having different roles, having to come in and find a different role, that can become troublesome. Somebody in the text line just said acceptance of roles is the problem. Yeah, and if you don't adequately explain that role when they come in, right, some of it is recruiting, you know, coaches and recruiters are saying, oh yeah, we're going to bring you in and you're going to be this and you're going to be that and you're going to be the best player on our team and you're going to average 20 a game and, you know, you're going to start every game and play 30 minutes and then they arrive on campus and it's like, actually you're going to come off the bench and you're going to play 14 minutes. Well, that's not what you told me. That's not what I was promised when I got here. You lull them in and you woo them with this false sense of security, and then they show up on campus. Well, why would they be willing to accept a role when you made no mention of that being their role when you recruited them? Otherwise, they wouldn't have come to your school in the first place. There's a lack of open honesty, I think, nowadays.
Yeah, and I can't speak to like what their recruiting was for these guys. I don't know what was said from Tang and his people.
No, and
players.
I'm not talking about Jerome Tang necessarily. I'm just, you know, sort of a blanket statement about college athletics.
It does happen for sure. But my thing is just when you're building your team, everybody can't be the star. You know, it's like you, especially in basketball too. Like basketball is a sport where like you might have a couple of guys that are stars on your team. Everyone else has a role and they have to play that role. And it just kind of feels like when you watch them play, it's like every one of those guys that they brought in that was like really good for another team comes in, and every time they touch the ball, they're like, I'm the best player on the court. And they play like they're the star. And sometimes you need guys to work together to let other people shine. Because, I mean, like, that's one thing, like, say what you want about, like, KU this year, but Bill Self usually has a team that is really balanced. You have your one or two star players, and then everyone else does their job around that person or people to help them succeed. You know, like, that's how you have, especially at college basketball, where the roles are a lot more defined than like in the NBA, where in the NBA you got guys like Victor Wembanyama, who's 7'3" and he can dribble like he's a point guard. Like, there's not that many guys out there in college ball who are over 6'9" that have handles the way that the guys in the NBA do. So, like, you can, it's a lot more fluid of a sport at the NBA level than it is in college, where there are more defined roles. And you need guys who are going to fit into those defined roles a lot more, because it makes it easier for them to play. Because most of these guys aren't talented enough to play the way they do in the NBA.
No
but
question.
But it seems like a lot of these guys are trying to do it now.
No question. I like what you said about not everybody can be a star. I agree. And that's why I think coaches and recruiters across college basketball need to stop recruiting everyone as if they're going to be a star. Yes, I get it. When you're on the recruiting trail and you're competing against another high major, you know, basketball program, and you want to land the player because you don't want them to, and you think he could be beneficial to your program, you're going to make all of these outrageous and outlandish promises to this player in the hopes that they'll sign with your school and bring him in. My question is, what is the benefit of that? When you make them all these promises, promises that you never have a chance, not one iota, of being able to keep, and then they come to your program, you put them in with the other guys on your roster, and they quickly realize, oh, well, this star role that I was promised is not going to come to fruition. I was lied to. What is the benefit to them, and what is the benefit to your program in that sense of like promising some 17, 18-year-old kid that he's going to come in and compete for a starting spot, and, you know, we think you're the kind of guy that could, you know, bring 10 or 12 or 15 points a game to us your freshman year. You could be a freshman of the year type, and you bring him in on campus, and he quickly realizes, like, oh, I'm going to be the third or fourth or fifth guy off the bench at best. Like, they may redshirt me. What is the benefit to lying to a player's face to bring them on campus if they're not going to be a benefit to your program because you lied to them?
Well, that's kind of a common recruiting tactic.
And that's
general.
What I'm saying. How is that beneficial to you?
It happens, I mean, as well as to them. It happens a lot. This is the reason why you have coaches like Nick Saban that don't like the idea of the transfer portal or don't like the idea of NIL, because it threatens the power structure. Because there were all these teams like Dabo Swinney as well. He had the same thing when he was actually really successful at Clemson, was that they were able to do that. Promise these kids the world, and they could hoard all this talent because these kids didn't have a choice. Now that they have a choice, you got Nick Saban out here trying to get out the game because he can't do the same things that he can't have five quarterbacks on his roster that could play in the NFL. He can't hoard five NFL running backs on his roster because, and this is like right now, you're actually starting to see this new phenomenon where a lot of these Power Five or Power Four programs are not having spring games now because they don't want other teams to see their backups play, because then they're going to start trying to recruit them and getting them to transfer over to their school, and they don't want to do that. Like, this is the game. Like, the game has always been to hoard as much talent as you can in college sports. They've done it in college basketball, done it in college football, because that's how you continue to win when you have 3 to 4 year cycles for these players all the time. And it's becoming really difficult now to be consistently successful in the sport because the players have more freedom to move. And that's something that scares a lot of these coaches. So you see guys like Tang go out there and I just got to get as much talent as I can because I might lose all my really good players either to the draft or to a bigger program.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how the balance of power has sort of leveled in college basketball and across college athletics for that matter. I think that's one of the prime examples of that, and, you know, I'll talk a little KU before we hit the break here. You know, Jayhawks got a big win on Saturday against Oklahoma State. Dominant showing for the Jayhawks, a 96-64 victory at Allen Fieldhouse in the fog. Hunter Dickinson with a double-double. He finished with 16 and 11 in this one. Zeke Mayo had 15. DeJuan Harris had 14. David Colt off the bench, or quite off the bench, had 15. It was an impressive win. It wasn't enough to keep them in the top 25, however, right? Jayhawks fall out of the top 25 for the first time in years. They had the second longest active streak in men's college basketball of being in the top 25. That is no longer. But I talk about the balance of power and how it's leveled a little bit. with K-State, or with KU now being out of the top 25, that now means that five of the 10 teams that opened up the season in the preseason top 25 are not in the top 25 now. Five of the top 10 teams in America when the season began are not even top 25 teams anymore, including KU and Gonzaga. It's a complete shift where other teams, other programs that haven't generally been successful over the years now have an opportunity to really make their mark. I mean, look at what St. John's has done this season, right? To go from unranked and
a great coach in Rick Pitino.
Bit of an afterthought, a great coach in Rick Pitino. They're now number 7 in America. They're 24-4. Nobody thought much of Wisconsin coming into this year. When you lose Chucky Hepburn and you lose AJ Storr, and it's like, what is Wisconsin going to look like this year? Well, they're the number 11 team in the country, and they're 21-6. Michigan's had a huge bounce back year. Mizzou, after not winning a single SEC game last year, they're 20-7, and they're the number 14 team in America. They moved up this week. Despite losing to Arkansas on Saturday, they moved up this week. That is the power dynamic that has shifted in college basketball and across college athletics, is that now it really does feel like on a game-by-game, week-by-week, year-by-year basis, the best teams in America can shift and shift dramatically. And I think that's the beauty of college sports. And I felt like over the last 15 or 20 years, especially in college football, we'd lost some of that. And I think we're starting to get a little bit of it back. It's not all good, right? Seeing kids leave and go to different programs. I was watching a duel yesterday. Iowa-Oklahoma State had a duel meet on BTN yesterday. I'm a big Iowa fan, big Iowa wrestling fan. And it was weird to see the number of guys wrestling at Iowa and Oklahoma State that were transfers, and that were like, Iowa was their third different college program. Like, there were kids that were like, yeah, I was at South Dakota and then Oklahoma, and then I was at Iowa State, or I was here and then it's Wyoming and then Oklahoma. And that is in some ways problematic.
That's that NIL money. Cause I know like Oklahoma State's got a pretty nice NIL budget when it comes to like wrestling.
No question. And so does the University of Iowa.
Yeah,
cause
Iowa's been very good at wrestling for a long time now. So
yeah, there's problems with it. Absolutely. But I like the fact that it has shifted the power dynamic a little bit, and it has given every school an opportunity to win. And I think we're seeing that right now. Still, the upper echelon programs have more money at their disposal to go win. Look at what Ohio State did in football this year, but it has allowed for other, look at what Indiana did, right? To go from Antoine Randall was the highlight of Indiana football in its history to making the college football playoff in year one with a new head coach. That's kind of the beauty of it in some respect. 913-586-7965 is our number. Logan Weber alongside Chris Unocero. You're listening to After Hours right here on 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5 The Fan.
At Odyssey. Talking college basketball right now on After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber alongside Chris Unocero producing the program here tonight. Man, this college basketball stuff has been fascinating to watch this year. We talked about K-State's loss yesterday against Arizona State, which has completely sunk their already slim NCAA tournament chances. The University of Kansas got a huge statement bounce back win against Oklahoma State on Saturday, taking down the Cowboys 96-64. For Mizzou, a tough matchup on Saturday against Arkansas that finished in a 92-85 loss in Fayetteville. And again, I said this last week, this points to, I think, the biggest problem that faces this Missouri Tigers basketball team. They're a great team. They have an offense capable of getting them to a Final Four. The question is, can they put it together defensively game after game over a 3-week stretch to get there? That is going to be the biggest hurdle for this Mizzou team. We saw them give up 98 to Alabama in a game that was defense optional. And then on Saturday, you give up 92 to an albeit a talented Arkansas team, but an Arkansas team that has certainly struggled in SEC play. They were 4-9 coming into this game, and they put up 92 on the number 15 team in America. All five starters for Arkansas finished in double figures. They shot 54% from the floor. That, I mean, 54% from the floor. That was one of the only statistics that Arkansas really dominated Mizzou in. 54.7% shooting to 44 for Mizzou. Both teams shot 33% at the line. Mizzou shot a little bit better at the free throw line. They had more rebounds in this game. It seems sloppy for the Tigers in this one, especially in the first half or the first 25 minutes of this game. They did a poor job of taking care of the basketball. They committed a lot of fouls in this game. As a non-biased observer, I'm not a Mizzou fan. I'm not an Arkansas fan. Watching this game, a lot of really questionable fouls by Mizzou. Not in terms of the officiating. I'm not saying they were ticky-tack fouls. I'm saying Mizzou fouls that were unnecessary, sort of reach in, you know, sort of just undisciplined sorts of. It seemed like a very undisciplined game from start to finish from Dennis Gates and the Missouri Tigers. Offensively, with their, you know, inability to protect the basketball, defensively with the fouls and the amount of open shots that were given to this Arkansas team. I mean, they put up 92 points and they only made 6 threes in the entire game. That's because they had 37 free throw attempts because there was a lot of fouling going on courtesy of Mizzou, although there were some questionable, you know, the officiating wasn't always isn't always going to be perfect, and it wasn't in this game. My only concern with this Mizzou team all year long has been defensively. Being stout enough defense. I'm not saying you got to hold a team to 60 points to win a basketball game, but it shouldn't be outside the realm to hold a team to 70, 75 points, because with your offense, you're going to win a whole lot more than you're going to lose with how they fill it up. When you got a guy like Caleb Grill coming off the bench that's giving you 10, 12, 15, 25 a night with his scoring prowess. I mean, Marquise Warwick put 16 on Arkansas on Saturday. Jacob Cruz off the bench scored 10, right? I mean, you still had five guys in double figures if you're Mizzou, but you gave up 92 points after giving up 98. You gave up 95 points last week on average.
When you're giving up 70 points a game like Mizzou is on defense, I mean, look, I've watched enough basketball over the years and I'm a Phoenix Suns fan, so I grew up watching a team that scored a lot of points and then gave up a lot of points on the back end.
That Mike D'Antoni offense.
Yeah, you know, 7 seconds or less, and it's like, it is very hard to win in basketball if you cannot play defense, period. It is just incredible, and especially when you have to foul. Because, like, teams that foul a lot, like Mizzou does, that means you're not good on defense. Like, you're fouling because you can't defend the guys in front of you. And if you watch enough basketball today, especially considering like how three dependent the game is now, we see it a lot in the NBA too, where teams rely heavily on the three. You shoot it a lot, and sometimes you're hot, sometimes you're cold. That's why we see so many blowouts in the playoffs now in the NBA, because there are so many times where teams just get hot, and then there's games where they're just absolutely like just freezing cold from beyond the arc, and they end up losing by 20, 30 points. Happens so much now because it's such a three-dependent game. When you can't defend and you are dependent on scoring a ton of points in order to be able to win, I mean, in a single elimination situation in like the NCAA tournament, I mean, I've seen a lot of teams go down that way because they cannot defend and they're reliant on scoring a ton of points in order to. When you're giving up 70, and like, granted, like, points per game has risen over the years in college basketball, but if you're averaging 70 a game on giving up on defense, that means you're asking your offense, you can't have an off night. Like, yeah. Once you get to March, you can't be off. Otherwise, we're going home.
Offense can keep you in games, but when it comes down to the end of February into March with conference tournaments and ultimately the NCAA tournament, it's not going to win you a lot of games. Yeah, it might win you a 4-13 matchup or a 3-14 sort of game. But when it comes down to a second weekend and you're a 4 seed and you've got to battle against a 3 or a 1 in a situation like that, if you want a shot at a you know, a bracket final and an Elite Eight appearance and a trip to the Final Four is on the line, those are traditionally, you see teams more often than not that are in the top 30 of the RPI defensively than they are in the top 30 offensively. I know it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. Typically, offense wins games, defense wins championships.
It's not even just that. It's like defense gives you more room for error because you can have an off night on off. I mean, it's basketball. Basketball, it's a percentage sport. You're going to fail a lot. You're going to miss a lot of shots. And there's times you're going to have an off night. That's why you want to have a good defense so that when you have your off night, you know that you're not going to get blown out. But when your defense is bad and the opposing offense is hot and your offense is not, that kind of creates a situation where you get blown out. And that's the thing that concerns me about, like, Mizzou's chances getting in, you know, when they get into the tournament. Because, I mean, you know how these teams, you know, especially, like, let's say they, you know, they end up in like a 4-13 matchup or a 3-14 matchup or something. We see it all the time. There's some mid-major out there and they just get hot. From beyond the arc, you know, they just start strapping from beyond the arc because they got nothing to lose anyways. They expect to lose the game in the first place. Everyone expects them to lose in the first place, so they gonna go out swinging. And if you have a bad night from the field, you gonna go home. And it happens so much in that sport, and that's the reason why looking at the way that they've been performing lately, offensively they're great, but we know that offense is very, very fickle in that sport.
As somebody who has spent the better part of my life watching Iowa men's basketball the last 15 years under Fran McCaffrey, it's a very, very entertaining brand of basketball to both play and admire and watch as a fan. Iowa typically under Fran McCaffrey has always finished as a top 25 offense in the country, right? Averaging 83, 84, 85 points a game. The problem is that they also give up 80 points a game. So it's like, oh man, this is the fourth best offense in college basketball, but they're 19-14 because they can't guard anybody. That, I think, could become a problem for Dennis Gates and the Missouri Tigers. And, you know, Chris, you mentioned, you know, when you get into a 3-14 or a 4-13 or a 5-12 matchup and you've got to play a really good mid-major team, it can become problematic. Well, we've got a mid-major team right here in the region. Now, they're a little bit north of us, but I kind of want to talk a little bit of Drake Bulldogs basketball here on the other side of this break. So we'll discuss what Coach Ben McCollum and the Drake Bulldogs have working this year. Could consider them a little bit of the Missouri Bulldogs based on their roster. We'll discuss that coming up next. You're listening to After Hours with Logan Weber and Chris Unocero, 96.5 The Fan, your home for Kansas City sports.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5.
This has been one of my favorite stories to follow in college basketball this year for a multitude of reasons. The Drake Bulldogs right now are one of the best teams in college basketball. The numbers back that up. The wins and losses back that up. They're 15-3 in the Missouri Valley Conference this year. They're 25-3 overall. And I'll kind of go about this and tell you why I'm fascinated by this in multiple phases. The first one is the most obvious of the group, and that is that I am a graduate of Northwest Missouri State University. And during my 4 years of college, Ben McCollum was the basketball coach at Northwest Missouri State. So I developed a relationship with Mac, as we all called him on campus. I worked for the athletic department. I was on the scout team for the women's basketball team. And I, of course, covered the team in a media capacity as a student on the campus of Northwest as well. And he was always a remarkable human being to be around, an excellent basketball coach, but even better, a great leader of men. One of my favorite things about going to school at Northwest and being associated with the athletic department was we had this tradition that we called noon ball. And it fairly simple. At noon, every day, Monday through Friday, barring, you know, other problems or maybe guys were out and about, road trips, whatever, we had basketball at noon at Bearcat Arena every day. And a group, you know, we had a big group chat on on, oh my goodness, I can't even remember what app we use, GroupMe. We had a big group chat on GroupMe, and somebody would send a message out at like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, noon ball, yes or no. And if you wanted to play, you would like the yes message. If you couldn't play or didn't want to play, you would like the no message. If we got 10 guys that voted yes, we're playing noon ball. And I would play with those guys every day. And all Mac did was win. And his guys bought in. And it was awesome. I watched them win a couple of national championships when I was a student. It was fun to be a part of, and it was fun to be associated with the athletic department. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, Coach McCollum is an Iowa guy, you know, born and raised in the state. He went to Northwest after playing junior college. I think he went to Central Iowa Community College, and then he transferred to Northwest where he played. He then became a coach at Northwest and had all this success, and now he's back in the state of Iowa. So I find that fascinating as well. The third part about why I've been so closely attached to this story is because prior to coming back up here to Kansas City and beginning work here at 96.5 and the stations here at Odyssey, I was working in Springfield, Missouri. And, of course, two of the biggest job openings in the Missouri Valley Conference this offseason was the job at Drake and the job at Missouri State University. And like I said, being a student at Northwest and being involved in the athletic department, I had connections and I had, you know, quote-unquote sources in and around those programs. And Ben McCollum was very open and honest with folks about, you know, what sort of jobs would he consider leaving Northwest Missouri State for. And the two jobs that he always mentioned in terms of mid-major jobs, because a high major job, he's obviously going to entertain that because that's a huge jump point. I mean, that's a massive leap. And of course, who would turn down a high major job? In terms of mid-majors, he said the two jobs he would always consider were the Drake job and the Missouri State job. He was fascinated by the Missouri State job down in Springfield and the market that is. He always thought that it could be a great spot for mid-major college basketball. And there was a big contingent of Missouri State fans that wanted Mac to come to Missouri State. But the now former athletic director at Missouri State University, his name was Kyle Motes, he took the initiative and he hired Konzo Martin, who, of course, had a good career at Missouri State and then went to Cal and Mizzou and Tennessee. And he had some success at the high major level as well, for sure. But he took the initiative, which I believe most of the fan base wanted to see Ben McCollum become the head coach. Instead, they hired Konzo Martin. So Mac goes to Drake. The interesting perspective on that decision can be seen via the Missouri Valley Conference standings. So, Chris, I don't know if you have the standings in front of you, but if you look at the Missouri Valley Conference men's basketball standings, right, Ben McCollum, considered by many in the Missouri State fan base the guy they wanted to have the job, he goes to Drake. Drake has already clinched at least a share of the Missouri Valley Conference title. They're 15-3, 25-3 overall. So they're at the top of the league standings. Then you look at the bottom of the league standings, and who's in dead last? Missouri State, who is 2-16 in the Valley, and they're 9-20 overall. So the guy you hired instead of Ben McCollum has you dead last in the league. Meanwhile, Mac, at a school in your own conference, top of the league, 15-3, 25-3 overall. So I find that fascinating. And for those who would ask, why should I give a damn about Drake men's basketball? Other than the fact that he was at Northwest Missouri State, which is cool in and of itself, you know, going from an hour and a half north of the metro. I'm a metro kid who went to Northwest. A lot of people in the metro are affiliated with Northwest in some respect. Look at the roster for the Drake Bulldogs. And I'll start at the top. Cam Monuwu, who played at Staley and then went to Wyoming, he's on this Drake roster. So that's a Metro kid. Played at Staley, who's now on this team. Isaiah Jackson, who was from Independence, played at Chrisman, went to Northwest with Mac and is now playing at Drake. Tavion Banks, who is a Kansas City kid. He played for Minnesota Prep and then went to Northwest Florida State College, is now playing at Drake. So another Kansas City area kid. Eli Shetler from Wichita and went to Andover, then Indiana State, now playing at Drake. Bennett Sturts, a Liberty kid who went to Northwest with Mac and is now one of the odds-on favorites to be the Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year. You've got Isaiah Howard, who played at Plattsburgh, which is a little bit outside of the metro, you could say, but a school that I'm very familiar with, having played against in high school. So another, you know, sort of Northwest Missouri, Kansas City area kid playing at Drake. Joe Mattione from Overland Park, who played at Blue Valley Northwest, is at Drake alongside Ben McCollum. So it's fascinating to see the number of guys, and one of their top assistants, Bryston Williams, is a Kansas City area guy as well, who is now at Drake alongside Ben McCollum. So a lot of guys from the metro area are playing at Drake under Ben McCollum. That's another part of this that I find incredibly fascinating, is that it goes to show you that high school basketball in Kansas City, Missouri is the real deal when you look at this Drake team and the amount of success that they're having. The Metro's got some high quality high school hoops.
Yeah, I did a lot of work for my high school. Like, I did scorebook and stats for them and whatnot, so I got to travel around with them. This is, you know, almost 20 years. It was 20 years ago now, but so I got to see a lot of players that would then go on and play at the collegiate level as well. This is a good, obviously, if you know, CDOT put out a documentary a few years ago from Paseo to Pembroke, and there were so many good players back in that era, like the late 90s, early 2000s, but you see even more now. We're not in that same era where there are like those big time like power four prospects, but there's still a lot of guys from the area that go and play around at the local colleges, and Kansas City is a good basketball city for sure. I actually went and watched that Drake team play K-State earlier in the season when they played at the T-Mobile Center. And man, they got some shooters on that team, and they were well coached, and you could just see it as like, you know, we talked about earlier, I think it was early in the hour, where we talked about like players figuring out roles and knowing how to play the others. You watch that Drake team, they know what they're doing. Like, every one of those players knows what their role is. And it was really eye-opening watching K-State play in that game, because you could kind of see the dichotomy in how those teams were built. And, you know, you saw K-State, a team where it was just like a bunch of good players. It looked like they were playing pickup ball. And then you see Drake, and it's like, okay, each one of these guys is willing to play a certain role that maybe isn't the most glamorous thing you're going to do on the court, but that guy knows exactly what he needs to do to help the team win, and there isn't a question of, okay, how am I going to shine? How am I going to star? And I think that part matters a lot in the sport, and I think that's the reason why, like, college basketball, I think for a lot of people can resonate a little bit more with the NBA, is because there are more defined roles, so it's easier to understand and easier to pick up. It's weird when you watch the NBA and you see somebody who's 6'10" crossing people up on the perimeter and hitting 3-point shots all the time. You see guys hitting 3-point shots all the time who are like over 6'8". That's just not common in college basketball. And I think that part there is different. When you go to college basketball, it's like the old school basketball, because there's guys who will back people down in the post. You don't see a lot of guys backing people down in the post in the NBA like that.
Yeah, and that's one of the fascinating parts about Ben McCollum's philosophy, is he doesn't play that traditional college basketball style. I mean, he'll go with a lineup where the center is 6'8" and he's playing 25 to 28 feet from the bucket. He likes to spread it out. He does not believe
they shoot a lot of threes.
Yes, he does not believe in the mid-range. That is not a part of his philosophy. He believes a lot in the analytics of the game. Play hard-nosed, physical 40-minute defense and shoot a lot of threes and get the ball inside the paint. You limit possessions. And you're right. I mean, he recruits guys to fit roles. And I know that people say this all the time about their programs, and coaches say this all the time about a family atmosphere and a family philosophy. I saw for 4 years as a student at Northwest him completely embody that. You know, he would have former players that would come back and become graduate assistants for him and become assistant coaches for him, because they wanted to stay attached to him and this program. And guys that would constantly come back, you know, they were working in Kansas City or they were working in Des Moines or Omaha, that would come to Northwest on a week-to-week basis to watch Northwest play at home in Maryville because they wanted to continue to be affiliated with the program and with Ben McCollum, because he's not only a tremendous basketball coach and has a great understanding of the X's and O's and is an excellent recruiter, he is an excellent leader of men. And I think that that has proven itself during his first year here at Drake. Somebody in the text line just said that they went to Northwest Missouri State back in 2016 and won the Natty. That was my freshman year of college when they won that first national championship with Kyle Pitts and Chrissy Buendow and Xavier Kurth and some of those guys. Coach is a beast for sure. He'll be big time in a couple of years if he wants. It may not take a couple of years. Like, he might be a high major coach at the end of this season. I saw an insane stat today. Ben McCollum, as a college basketball coach, has won at least a share of his conference's championship every year since 2012-2013. He has not lost a regular season conference championship in 13 years. That's a pretty remarkable run. And to go from Division II to Division I and play in a mid-major conference, the caliber of the Missouri Valley Conference, and to do that in your first year with a lot of guys that you brought from Northwest to Drake, pretty impressive feat, I have to say. 913-586-7965 is our number. We got a few minutes left here on tonight's program. Come back and wrap up the show here tonight. After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber here with you, my producer and co-pilot for tonight's program, Chris Unocero. 96.5 The Fan, it's your home for Kansas City sports.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5 The Fan.
We don't do a great deal of NBA conversation on our shows here at 96.5 The Fan, but I want to close out tonight's show and get your thoughts on this. 913-586-7965. And Chris, I want to bring you in on this conversation as well. So last night, the Golden State Warriors officially retired Andre Iguodala's jersey. And I'm not sure I agree with it. So Iguodala, extensive NBA career, played 19 seasons in the NBA. So a great deal of credit to him. He played 8 of those seasons for the Golden State Warriors. During that time, he was sixth man of the year twice. He finished second in the sixth man of the year voting twice. He finished fourth once. He was fifth for defensive player of the year voting one time, and he finished 10th for sixth man of the year one time. In 8 years with the Warriors, he averaged less than 7 points a game. He averaged about a steal, 3 rebounds, 3 assists. Those don't feel like stats that make you worthy of a jersey retirement. I mean, he did win a finals MVP, right? For holding LeBron to 29-8-8 in a series and somehow still won finals MVP.
Oh, he definitely did a really good job in crunch time against LeBron in that series.
Yes, in the final couple of, but LeBron still averaged 38. I mean,
yeah,
he was still unbelievable in that series.
He wasn't super efficient in that series.
Do you agree that a guy who averaged less than 7 points per game for a franchise over the course of nearly a decade deserves to have his jersey retired just because he put together seemingly one good series?
No, he was really good throughout their time. Like, a player's performance isn't measured just by, like, points they scored or assists or rebounds. Like, you know, you can watch how he played. He was one of the best defenders in the league on the perimeter when he played for the Warriors. Hell, he was one of the best defenders in the league when he played in general. Like, when he was with the Sixers, he wasn't, like, a super high-volume scorer. But, man, he was, like, a great two-way player. I think he was usually upper teens in terms of points per games when he was with the Sixers, but man, he could defend on the other end. He was one of the best perimeter defenders in the league. I know his stats aren't gaudy, but he was an integral part to the early part of that championship run for the Warriors. I think he more than deserves to have it retired by the Warriors, because I think that he was someone who really, I mean, without him, I'm not sure that the Warriors win that first series that they played there in the finals. I'm not sure, because he was really good when they needed him to be really good. So I mean, look, they had, that was the early makings of that dynasty. Iguodala, he balled out whenever they needed him to ball out there. And he was in it. Not only that, but he was also a really, really strong leader on that squad as well. And this was before Draymond Green kind of, started to become that glue guy that they had there. And Draymond was someone that I think picked up a lot of stuff from Andre Iguodala as well. Let's not forget, like, Iguodala was like a big free agent signing for them when he was a free agent coming out of Philly. Like, he was like one of the biggest free agents available when he hit the market there. So, yes, I think he more than deserves it, because I think contributions can be more than points in the sport of basketball.
All right. Maybe I'm the minority. All right. Maybe I'm that guy. Somebody in the text line said that he was their sixth man, a legend on defense, laid the foundation for the early Steph and Clay years. He was the glue guy.
Yeah. Like I said, he was the guy that put that made their defense what it was. Cause like Steph, he wasn't no great defender. Like, you're not going to put Clay on LeBron, but if you put Iguodala on there, and Iguodala, he did a hell of a job when he needed to. And so I'll give him, and like, you're not going to shut down LeBron. Ain't nobody shutting down LeBron. Like, even when Kawhi Leonard won MVP, what was it, 13-14? He didn't shut down LeBron, but he played well enough on defense to slow down LeBron enough to where they would win. They won that series. Like, You're not going to shut down a real star player in the league like that. Like, you might be able to slow him down, but you're not going to shut him down.
I mean, he was a great player. I'm not trying to discount that and what his contributions
were. We're not saying he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, but I think it's perfectly okay what the Warriors are doing.
I just can't say I can get behind a jersey retire. Like, nobody else in the history of that franchise can wear the jersey of a guy who won a Finals MVP and averaged 7.
I think that's their right.
If you put him in the rafters or what, I guess is fine. I mean, the Hall of, put him in your team's Hall of Fame is one thing, but to say that he was so outstanding that nobody ever else in the history of your organization could wear the jersey, that feels like a strong leap.
It's their,
like,
jersey.
Steph and Clay and Draymond
number
deserve to have their jerseys retired by the Warriors. Will Chamberlain deserves to have his jersey retired by the Warriors.
They will too. But Iguodala,
Chris Mullin,
very important.
I don't think Iguodala holds the same amount of water as some of those other guys I just mentioned, at least in the history of their organization. That'll do it for tonight's program. For Chris Unocero, my producer, I'm Logan Weber. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow from 6 to 9 right here on After Hours on 96.5 The Fan, your home for Kansas City sports.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5 The Fan.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.